BCFM Community Radio for Bristol on 93.2 FM. For more information or to listen live on the internet, go to our website at www.bcfm.org.uk. BCFM, your radio.
Hello and welcome to this week's Starlet Radio. The show is coming to you from Bristol City Centre and is part of the Bristol Radio Co-op. Hello to all of you in Bristol and also to our listeners in Preston, to those all over the world, including our new audience in South America. We have June Wentland with us in the studio today. June is a writer and publisher and she's going to talk about her experiences of publishing and what she can offer local writers. Tony Gosling has a feature about how to build your own sustainable home by Simon Fall, editor of The Land magazine in Somerset. And we have a clip of the Martin Bashir interview with Princess Diana that was originally broadcast on the BBC in 1995 as part of our little short season of stuff to do with Princess Diana. Also, as ever, Malcolm Greaves gives another chapter on the history of the Mafia, and we have Jess Bartz giving us What's On, and Anthea Page, who is now back amongst us in Britain, sends us a report on the Shining Path from Peru. Welcome now to our studio guest, though. First, June Wentland. Hello.
Hello.
Now, you are a writer and publisher, and you recently finished a book recently.
I did, yes. I'd written the manuscript a little while before and tried to get it published by mainstream publishers, but it's very, very difficult nowadays to get anything published by mainstream publishers because of the financial climate and so on. So it seemed a really good idea to actually publish the book myself, so that's what I did.
What did you know about publishing previous to this setting out? Did you have an experience of the publishing industry apart from sending your manuscripts off, obviously?
No, that was exactly what it was limited to. I didn't know anything at all about it.
Did you start? What did you do?
It was a very steep learning curve. At first, I went on a one-day course. It was actually provided by Bristol City Council. But obviously, there's not a lot that they can pack in one day, really. And from there, I read some books about publishing and so on. And then a lot of it was just forging ahead and having a go, really, and finding out things as I went along.
So what is your book about?
It's a children's story called Nana Computer Genius and the Amazing Roberta. And that managed to get all that together, and it was actually published last May that actually came out.
Through your self-publishing
interest? Yes, that's okay. Right, yeah.
If you do send a book off, what sort of response do you get? Do they give you any sort of active analysis of your book, or do you just get a slip back and says no thanks?
Varies quite a lot, really. If you're trying to get your book published by mainstream publishers, there's two approaches. You can either send it direct to a publisher or send it to an agent, and then the agent tries to get a publisher for you. So I've tried both of those methods. And it varies very much on the response that you get. Sometimes it comes back and you can just see that it's not actually been looked at all. Right through to people sort of giving you a really, really encouraging response, but still not actually publishing it. There was one instance where I'd sent the book off to an agent in London, and she'd emailed me, and the email had bounced and she'd actually thrown the manuscript away. But really wanted to give me feedback and wanted to see the rest of the book. I think I'd sent it 3 sample chapters. And she'd spent about half an hour in the snow going through the dustbin trying to find it for me again so that she could actually give me feedback about it, which is, you know, really nice thing to do when often you don't get any feedback at all.
So a mixture of kind of heartbreaking responses and really positive ones as well. But it must have damaged you, or you must have questioned yourself or your self-belief in your own book at some point. So what gave you the confidence to think, well, I'm going to do this myself and I'm going to publish it myself?
I think a lot of it was actually getting really positive responses from the readership it was actually meant to be for. So going into infant schools and reading it to them and getting a really, really good response from the children.
Okay. So what are you going to offer local writers with this experience? How is this going to work? Because obviously, just as a local writer, you also haven't got a lot of funds, and I can't imagine you know, banks going to give you a big loan to start a publishing company. No. So how does it work?
Absolutely not, no. The idea is that I think in the 21st century, the whole publishing industry is set to really, really change. Publishers can only publish a very, very small number of books now. So there's lots of writers sending out really deserving manuscripts and just getting them sent back all the time, or sometimes not even getting them sent back. Sometimes they just fester forever in a slush pile that the editor just never manages to get down to your particular part of the slush pile. So what I'm actually offering is the chance for writers to take control of their own manuscript themselves and actually see the product through from beginning to end. I found it a really empowering experience to actually be able to decide the layout of the book, the design of the cover, illustrations that went into it and everything, which is really good. So what I'm offering to writers is the chance for them to do exactly the same, but using my expertise so that they don't have to go through all the steep learning curve that I did. So I can offer them an honest opinion on whether it is really publishable standard and whether it will have a readership.
I was going to say, because a lot of publishing companies are usually quite authoritative in what they regard as publishable. So, I mean, if people come to you, would you actually turn people away and say, well, I don't think this is sort of really good enough to be bothered with, or would you just sort of say yes to everybody? So it becomes like vanity publishing.
Yes, no. What I would do, because I set up, as you know, the publishing company for my own book, which I've called Southwick Press. And I've now set up a sort of imprint of Southwick Press, which is called Magic Bean Books, which is actually for the self-publishing. But obviously, because I'm publishing my own books, I don't want things that are really sort of substandard and not really worth publishing to be associated with my own books as well. So I will certainly be giving people very honest responses, obviously in a really diplomatic way, and also kind of giving them an advice and things as well on how they can improve their writing and improve the product.
Okay, but if they are sort of persistent, you can kind of do sort of business with them through your Magic Beans book, sort of half of...
Yes, yeah, that's the idea, yes.
In a way, I mean, publishing of books kind of has dragged behind the music industry. The internet has sort of revolutionised, you know, you can be a band, set up your own professional page and do everything yourself, whereas books still seem to be stuck in kind of the old world. Have you met any other people who have had similar ideas to yours? Are there lots of people out there who want to start their own publishing enterprises?
I think there's an increasing number of people. I think, like you say, it's absolutely true that the publishing industry is stuck very far behind music, really, the music industry. And I think it's just about to change, really. And I think there will be really big changes in the publishing industry over the next few years.
So what do you see as sort of the problems, aside from the financial crisis, with the publishing industry? Why is it sort of got his head stuck in, why is it so far behind? What needs to change in big business to kind of make it kind of a bit more modern? Do you think big business is still going to work? Or do you think?
I think, to be honest, I think probably the publishing industry as we know it will change, because it has really got stuck in a rut and it hasn't really responded to the modern world in the same way that other industries have. But I think perhaps some publishing companies will start to change and will respond to other changes sort of in society that they need to respond to. But I think others will be just sort of stuck in the rut and won't change at all. So it'll be a very exciting time in a way for publishing over the next few years.
How are you going to get your finished product out? Are you sort of looking to distribution deals, or are you sort of beavering around in your mini delivering them yourself, or how does it all work?
It's not easy doing the marketing and advertising and distribution and so on when you self-publish and when you publish other people's work. But I think one of the sort of reassuring aspects of that is that now when people do get published by mainstream publishing, even if you're that lucky, there's not a lot of marketing and a lot of advertising that's put into it by mainstream publishers. What they tend to do now is put their limited advertising budget into people that are already established writers or celebrity writers. So it might be their first book, but because they've got a name in some other way, then that's where they actually put their advertising money. So if you get published by a mainstream publisher, I think a lot of writers are kind of rest on their laurels thinking that there's going to be a big advertising campaign to sell their book, and in actual fact, there isn't. And it was quite interesting finding out how many books usually sell that are made by mainstream publishers. And apparently for novels, they've done really, really well if they sell 200, which is a tiny number of books. So what I did for my own book and what I shall be doing for other writers is doing a sort of tailor-made advertising campaign. Mm. So actually contacting the people that are likely to be the main buyers of books and so on for that particular thing that they've done.
Right. How long have you been a writer?
Well, pretty much all my life, really. Yeah. From being able to sort of learn to write at school, I've always been writing in terms of like short poems and things. So pretty much all the time.
Was there a point where you thought, well, I do writing as a hobby, but now I'm actually going to call myself a writer more than your day job, so to speak?
Yes. Yeah. I think a few years ago, I decided it'd be really nice to spend more time on the writing, and it's really, really difficult sometimes to actually just forge that time out of the rest of your life. And I did register with Bath Spa University College and did an MA in creative writing, and that was really, really useful because it did make me sort of redefine myself as a writer, and meeting lots of other people that also define themselves as writers was really useful. And ever since then, I have seen myself much more as a writer and known that that's the way that I want my career to take off in.
Do you find your creativity works best when you sort of closeted away on your own, or do you like to sort of get together with other writers and do workshops? And what's your sort of style?
In terms of actually putting pen to paper, although I don't usually use a pen, it's more a laptop, I do need to be on my own for that bit, but that's the bit where you're actually getting it down actually on paper. And I think meeting with other writers is really, really useful in terms of inspiration and just giving each other that support, really.
If there are writers out there, I mean, what do you recommend sort of writers could do to sort of get in touch with other writers if they're just sort of sat at home looking at their story and don't really know what to sort of do with themselves? And
well, I think a good starting step would be to log on to my website,
okay,
which is www.southwickpress.co.uk. And on there, they can actually make contact with me. And I'm going to be getting together all sorts of different workshops and courses and things for writers, hopefully very, very near in the future.
Excellent. Have you got anything coming up to be published from Southwick Press?
Yes, I have got another. I've got another of my own books, which is going to be coming out hopefully sometime this year, which is a gift book for an adult readership this time, not a children's book. Mm-hmm. At the moment, I've got a number of enquiries that I'm giving quotes for and so on for other writers as well. So hopefully some of those will be coming out as well.
All right, so check out the website. There may be stuff coming up. Thank you very much for coming in today, and I wish you the very best of luck with your enterprise.
Thanks very much.
As the recession hits, some people are seeing this as obviously a bad thing, but other people are seeing it as a good thing and are embracing it as an opportunity to embrace the land. Simon Farley, the editor of The Land magazine in Somerset, has advice on how to build your own sustainable house.
I'm Simon Farley. This is The Land magazine, issue number 6, just out, hot off the press in February 2009. The editorial is called Three Cheers for the Recession. But the obvious reason why we need a recession is because going back and buying more and spending more is just going to cause more and more global warming. Well, we've got a long article on, well, two articles on Zimbabwe, assessing to what extent the chaos there is caused by Robert Mugabe and to what extent it's caused by the IMF policies. Also another one by Ian Schoons, looking at how successful land reform has been there and whether it's likely to continue in a good direction or not. We have several articles on global commons, one called An Ecosystem at Your Service, which I will leave you to guess what it's about. One called Over Our Heads, looking at the strange manipulations that are going on in the sky. another one about fishing called Land Reform for the Sea. We have a couple of feature articles, one on the fat of the land, which is about the mysterious alliance between vegetable oil and meat. And we have the second half of Edward Lloyd's manifesto, anti-transhumanist manifesto, called Slow Evolution is Co-Evolution.
What is a transhumanist then?
Transhumanists reckon, probably rightly, that we're all going to turn into cyber people in within the next century or two. Well, actually, they say it's going to happen in about 2050. But
we'll sort of all plug ourselves somehow into the internet or whatever and be connected by digitally.
Converging technologies, gene technologies and cyber technologies, all biological and technical ones, and nanotechnologies all converging.
Well, this sounds a little bit worrying. I think we should definitely be informed about this if this is going to happen.
Well, yeah, it's really worrying. It's the drift in which things are going, and there doesn't seem to be anybody drawing any lines to stop it, or even thinking about where lines should be drawn. It will only go that way if we don't fry to death with global warming. It's the fire which is the alternative to the frying pan, if you see what I mean.
It's not very good to talk about global warming in a winter where we've just had the first really heavy snowfalls for such a long time, is it?
Well, let's call it climate change then.
Okay.
And then, of course, at the back of the Land magazine, we have Chapter 7 News, which is a commentary on the planning system and low-impact development, which has, among other things, a big spread on benders. It's got a lot of photos from Lloyd Kahn's new book on Pacific Coast buildings, some great buildings there. Lots of appeal and planning decisions about low-impact places and so forth.
It's almost impossible to get planning permission, isn't it, if you want to build your own house in the British countryside. How's things going? Is it getting more difficult or is it easier, becoming easier?
It's getting easier, but most people get it at appeal. It's not getting any easier to get it through planning.
So the message is you've got to be persistent if you really want to build your own place.
Well, you had to be persistent anyway, even if you're a conventional developer, you had to wait for 5 years or so. I mean, this is what makes it really difficult for co-housing groups who want to self-build, is that they've got to get the land together, they've got to get the money together, they've got to get the people together, and they've got to get the planning permission. And the planning permission, even if they've got everything else together, the planning permission goes on and on and on for years. And people have to live their lives, and they just move away and emigrate to Spain or whatever, or another opportunity arises. Just always these groups of people, with really good ideas about building sustainable homes and co-housing groups and so on, and they just never get off the ground. They're just, deadened by bureaucracy.
Well, many countries, it's actually normal for people to be building and designing their own homes in other parts of the world. Why do you think it's so difficult in Britain, maybe Europe generally, but particularly in Britain?
Well, it's not that difficult in Europe. I mean, the levels of self-build in places like Austria and Germany, and actually most countries in Europe, are about 40 or 50, 60% of all houses, whereas here it's 8%. And the reason is because the whole residential construction industry is completely sold out to the large-scale house builders who buy options on land before it's even allocated in the plan, the bits with hope value, and then they push for those plots to be included in the local plan. And so by the time any land is allocated, it's already sold to Barrett and Wimpey and the rest of them, and the ordinary person doesn't get a look in, basically.
So is there any light at the end of the tunnel? Do you think is the system going to be changing to allow more little bits of building in the countryside? Or is it have the bureaucrats decided that the countryside is really for the animals and the plants and not for the people?
Well, no, it's not for poor people. That's what they've decided. But it's all more complicated than that. But there are ways of getting it, getting permission, and at the same time, you've got the planners have a point. If you let anybody do everything, you'd end up with a sort of American type suburbia spreading over the whole of the southeast of England. The thing is that there's enormous demand for people to build their own sustainable houses with or without access to land. And if it needs access to land, you're getting living from the land or part of your living from the land, then you've got a good case for living in the middle of the countryside. If all you want to do is grow a few veg that you could do on an allotment and have a little windmill and a chicken in your back garden, then you're better off sited on the edge of a town, or, you know, it's a new house on the edge of a town or the edge of a village. But planners are simply not allowing for that at all. They're not allowing anybody really, other than Barrett and Wimpy, to build new little boxes, and it's causing immense frustration amongst people. And I'm at chapter 7, which gives planning advice on this. I'm talking to people on the phone all the time who want to do this and want to construct a more sustainable lifestyle, just as Gordon Brown says they should, and can't do it. And of course, and there've been people trying to build eco villages for the last 30 years, and they never got anywhere. And then suddenly Gordon Brown comes along and says, "Oh well, let's have Barrett's build one in Bristol." So you're going to get another load of little Barrett's boxes, which are going to cost about £250,000, and that's not going to help any of the people we deal with.
Most of these big developers, aren't they being affected by the recession as well? I would imagine that the house builders themselves are thinking, well, hang on a minute, if we can't get credit to build houses, how can we build and sell them?
Yeah, well, it's all slowing down, but that they're sitting on the land that is allocated. They've got options on it, and they'll just wait till it picks up and.
So there's no hope of them going bust and us picking the land up at auction then?
Pretty unlikely, I'm afraid.
Okay, how do you get hold of your magazine then?
You can either ring us up, 01460 249 204, and ask for a sample copy, or you can email us on chapter7@tlio.org.uk and ask for a sample copy, or you can send £10, either as a crisp £10 note or else as a cheque or a postal order, to the land, the potato store, Flack Strait and Farm, South Petherton, Somerset, TA 13 5LR, and that will buy you a subscription of the next three issues. And three issues, they're fairly hefty issues.
And you're on the internet as well, you've got a website.
There's an old one there with the first three issues sort of pasted up, www.tlio.org.uk, and then you'll have to navigate your way to Chapter 7 and the Land magazine. There's a few issues up there, but we should have a new website coming up in the next month or two.
That was Simon Fairley talking about the latest edition just out of his magazine, The Land. And the website for it, again, is www.tlio.org.uk. And his number is 01460 249 204.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
I'd now like to introduce Rachel Edmondson, a Sheffield lass who's recently moved to Horfield, is that right?
Yeah, that's right.
And you've got a song for us you're going to sing, Mr. Tavistock.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay. Hey, Mr. Tavistock, I've got a synthesis for you. That Hegelian principle tells me you're doing pretty well. By nicking the great idea of consensus and manipulating it so you can conduct a meeting where the outcome's predetermined by you. Hey, I'm a teacher, but nowadays I don't get a say in how to do my job, even though I'm in a meeting every day. And I'm trying to give a lecture, but some guy came and did a talk, and he synthesized an answer, and now that's a blueprint for how I work. I'm in love with Mr. Tavistock. I'm in love with Mr. Tavistock. And this great new world gets braver every day. Hey, Mr. Tavistock, you're talking again. What exactly is this common purpose you've been training me in? Well, facilitate this debate. What I don't understand is when someone tries to question what you say, they're a troublemaker, they're crazy, causing conflict, making a scene, made to feel stuffy and or small. You're just trying to do your job. Can't we just get on? Can't we just all do exactly what you say as a result of thinking in this way? Don't be rude or disrespectful, just go with the flow. You say, I'm in love with Mr. Tavistock. I'm in love with Mr. Tavistock. And this great new world gets braver every day. Well, my thoughts are not my own. I couldn't articulate, I was alone. Yeah, I knew something was wrong, but I couldn't speak, and now the chance is gone. And I made a decision on behalf of my community, but it didn't sit quite right. But now what are you gonna do? You say, I'm in love with Mr. Tavistock. I'm in love with Mr. Tavistock. And this great new world gets brighter every day. I'm in love with Mr. Tavistock. I'm in love with Mr. Tavistock. And this great new world gets braver every day.
So what possessed you, Sheffield being such a beautiful place, to want to come to horrible Bristol?
Because it's not horrible and it's actually much better than Sheffield. No, just in the sense that there's a lot of music and culture and stuff going on here. So.
Ah.
Yeah, so I came down. I'm also at uni doing psychology.
Okay. Is that UWE or University of Bristol?
I'm at UWE.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
Right, well, thank you very much. Well, we'd like to have you back. And nice in future weeks, come and sing some songs, is that good?
Will do, definitely. Cheers, thank you.
Thank you very much. And Rachel Edmondson does do open mic nights, if you want to go along, at the Cabelli in Robertson Road in Easton. It's the second Saturday of each month, Saturday night of each month. It's time once again now for another chapter of The History of the Mafia, abridged especially for dialect radio and read by the actor Malcolm Greaves.
History of Organised Crime by David Southwell. The reason why Lucky Luciano was so well prepared to survive the assassination attempt in 1931 was that he'd been making his own plans for seizing control of the Mafia for years. This was how Luciano could respond instantly, by calling up a squad of four Jewish hitmen to smoothly wipe out his would-be killer the moment he got the fateful call to come into Maranzano's office. Luciano had not been making those plans alone. He had been working on them with Meyer Lansky, a Jewish gangster, and possibly one of the greatest criminal minds of the 20th century. No one could definitively say how and when Luciano and Lansky and their joint friend Benjamin Bugsy Siegel had met. Underworld myths are a legion about the fateful meeting. Most seem to revolve around Siegel and Lansky visiting one of Luciano's whorehouses, or Lansky saving Siegel from a Luciano beating by smacking Lucky in the head with a wrench. Such details are much less important than the fact that the three became lifelong friends and broke down the existing racial barriers that prevented Italian and Jewish gangsters mixing and even working together. Luciano did not merely want power. The vision that he and Lansky had was much grander than simply killing Maranzano and having Luciano replace him as the boss of bosses. They wanted to create a lasting national organised crime network where Italian and Jewish gangs cooperated, and that was administered by a board of directors. With no loyalty owed to or controlled by the Sicilian Mafia, and without all of the old baggage of rituals, oaths, and ancient blood vendettas, Lansky and Luciano began to actively plan to seize gangland power, and to usher in their scheme of a unified organised crime setup in 1928, the year that the man who had inspired much of it, Albert Rothstein, was murdered. With Rothstein's death, it was up to Lansky and Luciano to take their old mentor's dream, a national crime network, forward. When Lansky's hit squad wiped out Maranzano in 1931, and Luciano took control of the newly formed Cosa Nostra, they were at last in a position to put their plan into action. They called it the National Syndicate. At its head was the National Commission, a six-man advisory board of top mafia and Jewish gang leaders that adjudicated over disputes. Reporting to the National Commission was the Chicago Outfit, the mafia families in other U.S. states, and the New York Commission. They would act in the same way as the National Commission over the five families of Cosa Nostra that Maranzano had set up. Luciano took over control of the Masseria crime family, but the other crime families remained intact and were allowed to keep their old rules and ritual. To enforce the new order, keep the peace, and guarantee that the word of the National Commission was always final, Lansky created Murder Incorporated, the name given to an elite group of hitmen that were only available for hire to mob bosses on commission-sanctioned murders. Between them, it is thought that they killed more than 500 men on the orders of the Commission between 1933 and 1940. The new organisational structure of confederated gangs working across the ethnic divide that had once been dreamed of by Rothstein was made to work by Luciano, Lansky, and the deadly muscle provided by Murder, Inc. The fact that the same basic structure in the National Commission still exists and directs much of the American Mafia today is a testament not only to its founders, but also to its basic strength as an idea. One of the reasons Cosa Nostra and allied organized crime groups thrived under the structure and leadership provided by the National Commission was because it ensured the National Syndicate and all Mafia families kept as hidden from view as possible. The Commission strictly vetoed any hits on journalists, prosecutors or politicians that would have drawn massive untoward attention to it. They also reined in any conspicuous activity by Cosa Nostra or its members that could potentially raise their public profile. Even leading Mafia members had to obey. Dutch Schultz was gunned down in 1935 when he ignored the Commission and began planning the assassination of Special Prosecutor Thomas E. Dewey. Whilst New Jersey boss Willie Moretti's violent end in 1951 had much to do with his loose-lit performance in front of the Kefauver Committee hearings on organised crime. The rigorous enforcement of the Code of Omerta and the brutal clamping down on all who jeopardised Cosa Nostra's low profile was a great triumph. By staying below the radar of law enforcement and public concern, the National Syndicate was able to expand without any concerted, coordinated attempt to fight its growing power. It was not until the Kefauver hearings held between 1950 and 1951 that the public had even heard the word Mafia. There was massive ignorance as to its structure and who its leaders actually were. In fact, up until Appalachian in 1957, when it all went wrong, their strategy of secrecy was so successful that even FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover could claim that there was no such thing as the Mafia. The National Syndicate's ruling body was the National Commission. It held meetings with wider leadership of the syndicate's component groups at least once every couple of years. There was no fixed agenda, but the crime conventions provided an opportunity to resolve disputes, confirm changes of leadership within a family, and agree the position on contentious issues. In 1957, the National Commission Convention was to be held on November the 14th at the country home of Joseph Barbara in Appalachian, upstate New York. Barbara was a former member of the Buffalo crime family who had gone legit and was now running a successful soft drink distribution business. His home had previously been used for meetings of the New York Commission and Buffalo family. One item of business that was going to be discussed was Vito Genovese's attempt on the life of Masserio Luciano crime family boss Frank Costello that had forced Costello into retirement. Genovese was hoping that the National Commission would grant clemency over the affair and agree to his continuing control of Costello's old family. Almost 100 of the top mafiosi descended on Appalachian. They were conspicuous in their expensive handmade suits and luxury cars, but it may have been Barbara booking out all the motel rooms in the area that alerted the state police to something unusual happening. It was, however, probably more likely to have been a tip-off from either Costello or Lucky Luciano, who had been invited to the meeting but decided not to attend, as a way of getting revenge on Genovese. Whatever it was that alerted the New York State Police, they sent representatives along with two officers from the Alcohol and Tobacco Tax and Trade Bureau to investigate. They turned up at Barbara's estate in the middle of a barbecue. When they saw the police car pull up in the driveway, the mafia bosses fled the house and ran into the surrounding fields and woods. Whilst Chicago boss Sam Giancana and nearly 40 others succeeded in getting away, a total of 58 others were arrested. The captured men's names reads like a who's who of the mafia. and included such top names as Joe Profaci, Vito Genovese, Santa Trafficante Jr. and Carlo Gambino. Most explained their presence as being due to either visiting a sick friend or having experienced a car breakdown. Whilst all of them were eventually released, the exposure put the Mafia and the Syndicate firmly in the national spotlight. No one, least of all J. Edgar Hoover, could now deny the existence of the Mafia.
Thank you very much to Malcolm Greaves, and we'll have another chapter of the history of the Mafia next week.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
The inquest into Princess Diana's tragic death took more than 10 years to happen, and even then left many questions unanswered. We heard about some of them last week in our extract from the Discovery Channel documentary Who Killed Diana? This week, in dedication to her memory, we begin the serialisation of what is Diana's most well-known interview with the BBC's Martin Bashir. It was watched back in 1995, just 2 years before she died, by Panorama's biggest ever television audience. And, surprisingly though, it has never been heard since. So we split it up into 7 parts, and we're going to play it for you across the next few weeks. This is part 1, Prince Charles and Diana marrying in 1981, and her finding her feet in the royal family.
Your Royal Highness, how prepared were you for the pressures that came with marrying into the royal family?
At the age of 19, you always think you're prepared for everything, and you think you have the knowledge of what's coming ahead. But although I was daunted at the prospect at the time, I felt I had the support of my husband-to-be.
What were the expectations that you had for married life?
I think like any marriage, especially when you've had divorced parents like myself, you'd want to try even harder to make it work, and you don't want to fall back into a pattern that you've seen happen in your own family. I desperately wanted to work. I desperately love my husband, and I wanted to share everything together. And I thought that we were a very good team.
How aware were you of the significance of what had happened to you? After all, you'd become Princess of Wales, ultimately with a view to becoming Queen.
I wasn't daunted, and I'm not daunted by the responsibilities that that role creates. It was a challenge. It is a challenge. As for becoming Queen, it was never at the forefront of my mind when I married my husband. It was a long way off, that thought. The most daunting aspect was the media attention, because my husband and I, we were told when we got engaged that the media would go quietly, and it didn't. And then when we were married, they said it would go quietly, and it didn't. And then it started to focus very much on me. And I seemed to be on the front of a newspaper every single day, which is an isolating experience. And the higher the media puts you, place you, is the bigger the drop. And I was very aware of that.
How did you handle the transition from being Lady Diana Spencer to the most photographed, the most talked about woman in the world?
Well, it took a long time to understand why people were so interested in me, but I assumed it was because my husband had done a lot of wonderful work leading up to our marriage and our relationship. But then during the years, you see yourself as a good product that sits on a shelf and sells well. And people make a lot of money out of you.
It's been suggested in some newspapers that you were left largely to cope with your new status on your own. Do you feel that was your experience?
Yes, I do, on reflection. But then here was a situation which hadn't ever happened before in history, in the sense that the media were everywhere, and here was a fairy story that everybody wanted to work. And so it was isolating, but it was also a situation where you couldn't indulge in feeling sorry for yourself. You had to either sink or swim, and you had to learn that very fast.
And what did you do?
I swam. We went to Alice Springs, to Australia, and we went and did a walkabout, and I said to my husband, what do I do now? And he said, go over to the other side and speak to them. I said, I can't, I just can't. He said, well, you've got to do it. And he went off and did his bit, and I went off and did my bit. It practically finished me off there and then, and I suddenly realised, I went back to our hotel room and realised the impact that, you know, I had to sort myself out. And we had a six-week tour, 4 weeks in Australia and 2 weeks in New Zealand, and by the end, when we flew back from New Zealand, I was a different person. I realised the sense of duty, the level of intensity of interest, and the demanding role I now found myself in.
Were you overwhelmed by the pressure from people initially?
Yes, I was very daunted because, as far as I was concerned, I was a fat, chubby 20-year-old, 21-year-old, and I couldn't understand the level of interest.
At this early stage, would you say that you were happily married?
Very much so. But the pressure on us both as a couple with the media was phenomenal and misunderstood by a great many people. We'd be going around Australia, for instance, and all you could hear was, oh, she's on the other side. Now, if you're a man, or my husband, a proud man, you mind about that. You hear it every day for 4 weeks, and you feel low about it, you know, instead of feeling happy and sharing it.
When you say she's on the other side, what do you mean?
Well, they weren't on the right side to wave at me or to touch me.
So they were expressing a preference even then for you rather than your husband?
Yes, which I felt very uncomfortable with, and I felt it was unfair because I wanted to share.
But were you flattered by the media attention particularly?
No, not particularly, because with the media attention came a lot of jealousy. A great deal of complicated situations arose because of that.
At this early stage in your marriage, what role did you see for yourself as Princess of Wales? Did you have an idea of the role that you might like to fulfil?
No, I was very confused by which area I should go into. Then I found myself being more and more involved with people who were rejected by society, I'd say drug addicts, alcoholism, battered this, battered that, and I found an affinity there. And I respected very much the honesty I found on that level with people I met, because in hospices, for instance, when people are dying, they're much more open and more vulnerable and much more real than other people, and I appreciated that.
Had the palace given any thought to the role that you might have as Princess of Wales?
No, no one sat me down with a piece of paper and said, this is what's expected of you. But there again, I'm lucky enough, the fact that I have found my role, and I'm very conscious of it, and I love being with people.
So you very much created the role that you would pursue for yourself, really? That was
yes.
What you did?
I think so. I remember when I used to sit on hospital beds and hold people's hands, people used to be sort of shocked because they said they'd never seen this before, and to me it was quite a normal thing to do. And when I saw the reassurance that an action like that gave, I did it everywhere, and we'll always do that.
It wasn't long after the wedding before you became pregnant. What was your reaction when you learnt that the child was a boy?
Enormous relief. I felt the whole country was in labour with me. And enormous relief, but I had actually known William was going to be a boy because the scan had shown it, so it was no surprise.
Had you always wanted to have a family?
Yes, I came from a family where there were four of us, so we had enormous fun there. And then William and Harry arrived. Fortunately, two boys. It would have been a little tricky if it had been two girls. But that in itself brings responsibilities of bringing them up. William, future being as it is, and Harry was sort of like a form of a backup in that aspect.
That was part one of Princess Diana, Queen of Hearts, where Panorama BBC interviewer was Martin Bashir. Next week we've got part two, after the arrival of William and Harry and dealing with depression and bulimia as an escape mechanism.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
Last week, you'll remember, we spoke to Mohammed El-Haddad from Bristol University, who's just set off on a 5,000-mile journey as part of the Viva Palestina-Gaza aid convoy. Well, we promised to keep you up to date with where he is and how he's getting on. Dialect's Tony Gosling spoke to him earlier on today.
This is Mohammed El-Haddad. I'm, part of the convoy from London to Gaza, lifeline. At the moment, I'm just in the port. I've just arrived to the port in Spain. to cross the border to Morocco. I'm one of the people who were left behind because I'm responsible for those people who left behind, whether breakdown or the accident or to the hospital or these type of things. So anyway, we are just on the port and everything is fine. We really struggled with the breakdown covers. The AA was very bad, no service at all. The RIC, the same. We've been covered fully to get ourselves, secure within this country. But I'm afraid the breakdown wasn't really efficient as we thought.
Okay, so anyway, how has things been going with the convoy as a whole? It sounds like most of the convoy is now ahead of you.
Everybody ahead of me, they are waiting for me in Morocco right now, just after the border, straight away.
You're not the last in the convoy, are you the last?
I'm the team leader of the last people.
Okay, so is it your car that's broken down or have you been helping other people?
No, I'm just supervising. I'm responsible for them.
Okay, so it's other people's vehicles that have broken down. Anyway, so you'll be into Morocco when?
In about a couple of hours.
Fantastic. Anyway, look, what we'll do is we'll have another link up next week and wish you all the very well. Do you know where you'll be next Wednesday?
Next Wednesday, we'll enter the border of Libya.
Fantastic. We'll have a chat to you then, Mohammed. All the best.
Okay, thank you so much for that.
And we hope to hear more from Mohammed again next week as he passes through Libya on the way, bringing aid to the bombed and besieged people of Gaza. Our intrepid reporter, Anthea Page, has just recently returned from travelling around South America. In this clip she's brought us, she interviews Ludovic about his experiences of the Shining Path, a terrorist movement in Peru that is still active in northeast Peru. Only last week, the BBC World News featured an item on this group and the Peruvian government's attempt to stamp it out.
This is Ludovic speaking. I am 25 years old and I'm from Peru and I'm living now in Cabanaconde, which it belongs to Arequipa, 5 hours from Arequipa.
Can you tell us a bit about the Shining Path?
Yes. So now I live in Cabanaconde because in the 80s and 90s was the terrorism times in the place that I was born, which is called Ayacucho. And so when we're kids, we have to emigrate to the coast, and that's why we're here, because my parents decide to move from Ayacucho because it was the red area for terrorists. And Shining Path was in Ayacucho.
Can you tell us what the Shining Path were about?
The Shining Path was a group of terrorists led by Abimael Guzman, who was a teacher of philosophy at the university in Ayacucho. So he was a teacher who went to China and other countries, and he came with those ideas. And every time he was giving lessons in the university, he was talking all the time about communism. So he started to convince teachers and students to belong to his group called Shining Path. No? And that was in the 80s. So he started having the teachers and the students as leaders. And then they went to the farms outside of Ayacucho to convince the poor people to belong to their group, no, to Shining Path. And they wanted to get to the power,
yeah,
like communism. No, they were saying to the farmers, "If you are with us, we'll get to the power and you will have good life."
So, no? How many people were affected in the town?
The main city who was affected was Ayacucho, and then spread out to other provinces like Huancayo, Huancavelica, Junin. So there were more than probably more than 100,000 people that belonged to Shining Path at the beginning. They killed people, especially police people, soldiers who were against the Shining Path. But after 5-6 years, they start to kill each other because the farmers were scared. And Shining Path was a terrorist group that they make pressure to the farmer people. No? And every time they went to a new farm to convince two people to belong to their group, if they didn't belong, they had to kill them. So
how many people did they kill?
I think it's more than 75,000 people. A lot of different punishments, and they put a lot of bombs in the cities, especially in Lima. Militars as well killed innocent farmers because the militars thought that most of the farmers were terrorists, but at the end, not everybody belonged to Shining Path. So they were killing each other, no? Because there were a big confusion between the Shining Path and farmers.
So tell us about your father.
My father, he was a merchant there. And when we were living in Ayacucho, he had a truck, and he used to bring products from the coast, then take to the mountains, and then sell it in the mountains, and then buy things from the mountains, and go to the jungle. And he had to make a lot of terrorist friends. So, but he have to pay like 20% of the truck, he have to pay to Shining Path. And so it took many years that my father took the decision to move to the coast, because after they were asking 20%, when Shining Path was getting more power, they wanted to ask more percentage. And they were asking 40%, almost the half of his truck. So that's why my father decided to move to the coast.
Why did the power? What time?
The bad times of Shining Path. They started in 1979, but the strong problems with Shining Path was 1982 till 1993. So that's where many people died. No?
How did they lose power?
Because the leader, Abimael Guzman, he was in Lima, and the police find out where he was. So he was the head. Yeah. So once the head was in jail, everything collapsed, because without the leader, they couldn't keep doing.
So is there any terrorists left, terrorist activity?
Oh yeah, still some terrorist groups in the jungle, in Ayacucho, but they are working now more with drugs, narco-terroristas, we call them. No?
Oh.
And just some weeks ago, they killed like 6 people in the jungle, police people. And the jungle is so huge that it's hard to find them. Like it's like in Colombia, no? Like the FARC, they are spread out in the jungle. But the government says that there is about probably 1,100 people that still belong to Shining Path. Well, which is not a lot comparing to the old times. Like in old times, most of the people from the mountains belong to Shining Path. But then they start too quick. They start too quick. No?
So what about this town in the south? Here?
Terrorism didn't reach till the south part of Arequipa or Peru. No, only was in Ayacucho, Huancayo, and Cusco, which is more the north and central highlands. But in Arequipa was not too much. That's why we moved to Arequipa, because it was a safe place.
Yeah.
No, but in the 80s was a very dangerous times. There were terrorists everywhere, so they stopped you. If you were going to the mountains, for sure, Shining Path stopped you to ask you money and supplies, food supplies. And they even had a big list of people who didn't want to belong to Shining Path. So every time they stop a bus, they enter with guns into the bus, and they were asking their IDs, so they collect the IDs, and they were checking the huge list. So if you were in the list, you were taken from the bus and then shoot in front of all the people and put it a big sign saying that this is what it happens to the traitors, people who didn't want to fight for the Shining Path.
You can hear more on South America in next week's show. Well, to pass the time away until we get to spring, let's find out what's going on with the leather trench-coated and bequiffed Jeff Sparks.
Thank you, John. Good evening. This is your What's On Guide from Dialect Radio. Kicking off with Friday, 27th of February, and at the Prom Bar in Bristol, Nuttiness will be performing. This band used to be called One Step Below. Doors open at 8 p.m. and entry is £4 on the door. Also on 27th of February and at the Louisiana in Bristol, Fortune Drive will be performing with support from Liner and also The Goodness. Doors open at 8 p.m. and tickets are £5 in advance. Moving on to Song of the Week, and I bring to you a local band called Jacanda. This is from their latest album, Skimming Stones, and it's a track titled Ashes.
Flick the ash from the table, put my elbow down where it's day. Get my head in my hands like my glass, I'm so drained. Once was quiet is now noisy. What's distinct's become blurred. And I'm driven by voices much louder than the ones you think I've heard. The things in my head will make you cry in your sleep. Cause I'm no angel, I'm the good shepherd and you are my sheep. When the devil's in pinstripe wave targets and claws like a matador, the messenger, the sweeper on a killing floor. If only they knew, if only they see what it is that I have in store, then maybe they'd long to be a freak with a vision, a freak just like me. Scan the room without feeling. Let my sight fill the air. Sitting coiled like a cobra, I'm ready to strike without care. When all of my demons cry out in one voice, cause I'm your preacher man. Into my arms now, you have no choice. When the devil's in pinstripe, wave targets and gloss like a matador. Messenger, the sweeper on a killing floor. If only they knew, if only they see what it is that I have in store. Then maybe they'd long to be a freak with a vision, a freak just like me.
That was Jacanda with Ashes from their latest album, Skimming Stones. For more information, check out myspace.com/Jacanda. Moving on to Saturday 28th of February, and at the Thecla in Bristol, Igloo and Hartley will be performing. Doors open at 7 p.m. and tickets are £9 in advance. Also on 28th of February, and at the Golden Lion, which is at 244 Gloucester Road in Bristol, Rogue Dolls will be performing. The gig starts around 9 p.m. and entry is free. And finally on 28th of February and at the Polish Club in Bristol, Steve Payne and Friends will be performing with support from Honey on My Grave. Doors open at 8 p.m. and tickets are £7 in advance. And on Sunday 1st of March at the Louisiana in Bristol, the Night Stars will be performing with support from Psycho Baby and also Road to Recovery. Doors open at 8 p.m. and tickets are £4 in advance. That is all from me. Thanks for listening and have a great week. Take care and goodbye.
Well, our Tony Gosling is starting to yawn and tire, so it's time for the end of the show. Just time to tell you a reminder of some numbers and addresses. Simon Fairley's Land magazine can be seen on the internet at tlio.org.uk and his number is 01460 249 204. You can always check out radiodialect.co.uk and we'll have details of lots of our stuff that we've talked about on there. Thank you to June Wentland also. You can check out southwickpress.co.uk if you want to find out more about being able to publish your book if you are struggling. The feature on how to build your own sustainable home was brought to us by Tony Gosling, who also contributed to the Martin Bashir clip. More of that next week. Our guest musician was Rachel Edmondson and we hope to hear more from her in future weeks. Thank you to Malcolm Grieve, who read another instalment of The History of the Mafia, and the Shining Path feature was brought to us by Anthea Page, now back in the UK. Jess Sparks brought us the What's On Guide, and Villis Church-Curran was the studio engineer. This week's show was produced by Anthea Page. You can download the show on the internet at dialectradio.co.uk. Hello to people in Preston, and thank you to BCFM. Goodbye from all of us here, and goodbye from me, John Peters Coleman. Until next week, take care.